Thank you very much, Rabbi Matanki. And I want to also acknowledge Rabbi Brand and why you call Torah Mitzion, and thank the sponsors of that, of the Aaron and Rivka Friedman call Yom Rishon here at in Chicago. And I also want to thank Kayla Eisenbach for being in touch with me and arranging. And also acknowledge the Mordasra of the Shura by Engel. I also want to mention that I was here a few years ago in a different venue. I don't remember the exact title of the memorial lecture in memory of Dr. Greenfield. So I was here a few years ago and had the opportunity to speak in the shul at that particular event. So I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for being here and staying here on a Sunday morning here in Chicago. I come from the Midwest originally. I'm from Detroit. So I'm not... I can identify with you a little bit, although in a much earlier stage, my Red Wings were disqualified by the Bruins. So you made it a little bit farther, but not quite as far as, I guess, the West and East Coast. But nonetheless, good luck for next year. I still remember the days. This has nothing to do with medical ethics. It actually does, because when I was growing up, hockey players didn't wear helmets. And even when they introduced helmets, hockey players were not required to if they had not been wearing them until then. There is some medical ethics in there somewhere. Probably has to. It didn't quite affect. Well, it's related to brain death a little bit, in a sense, because if you think about the injuries that were taken, and nonetheless, certainly caused injury to the thing, just like in football. But nonetheless, so I wish Chicago good luck in that regard. So I wanted to focus this morning in the time that I have on an issue that actually originates out of here, out of Chicago. So, okay. There was a case a couple years ago, in March of 2010, regarding a couple. Actually, she was a doctor. He was a nurse firefighter. She was much older than he. She was now, she's about 42 years old. He was about 33 years old. Her name is Carla Dunston. And he and she, Jacob Shafransky, were dating. They were boyfriend-girlfriend. They were not married. And but they were dating, and she developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and for which she was treated. And in anticipation of the treatment for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, she decided to generate eggs, follicles, oocytes, eggs. And her boyfriend, Jacob Shafransky, donated his sperm. They fertilized them in vitro fertilization, created a number of embryos, and froze those embryos. Not long after she was treated for the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, they broke up. He basically ended the relationship. It's actually described in an article that he texted her that he was breaking up. Certain finesse, I guess, in that. So the issue came up is that once she was treated, she wanted to use the frozen embryos to be reimplanted in her uterus in order to potentially have them implant in the uterine wall and to conceive. They both signed an agreement that basically stated that they both had to agree and consent for the embryos to be transferred. And he was very, very hesitant. Basically, he opposed the process. In part, apparently, he was concerned that his having a child through this process would mean that he has a child. Although I think she accepted, I think, to take care of the child financially, if I'm not mistaken. I don't remember now specifically. But either way, he was concerned that having that child would either obligate him or it would create a potential problem for him in a next relationship. Because if he enters a new relationship and he has a child somewhere, then that could be difficult for him. So he didn't want to consent. So they went to court. And just a few weeks ago, here in Chicago, the Supreme Court, the judge siding with a Chicago woman seeking to use frozen embryos to have a child over the objection of her former boyfriend. namely that she was diagnosed, the story tells, and that she, at least now, he has appealed it, but the court awarded her the right to use the embryos in opposition to the sperm donor's insistence against that, and that he would not be able to post it. So he's appealing that case, and there are some legitimate questions that arise from that in terms of who has proprietary rights over what happens to the embryo. Does a person have no decision, absolute decision making, to resist becoming a parent? Basically, he's basically being forced upon to become a parent, where he doesn't want to become a parent. Questions have to do with the legalities of the arrangement and the agreement that they made together. Issues of the interests of a woman to have a child when she cannot have a child in other means because of the effect of the chemotherapy in her non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that resulted in her inability to not be able to carry a child, but be able to produce. Basically, it caused the death of her follicles, of her oocytes, of her eggs. So those are some of the issues that come up. So that was the case just here in Chicago. Carla Dunstan, I'm trying to look for his name. Oh, yeah, I mentioned Jacob Szafranski. I don't know his ethnicity exactly, but nonetheless, that's Ed's story. So I wanted to kind of analyze that story, that local story here in Chicago, and kind of develop it based on some ideas that have come up in cases that have been discussed by the postgame. So to start off with, I'd like to share with you an idea from Shmuel HaLevi Vozner as presented to him and asked by Avram Friedlander. So I've lived in New York for many years, even though I came from Detroit originally. I lived in New York for many years. I went to medical school in Detroit, but I did an internship in general medicine at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, and also did some publishing with the Genesis Fertility Clinic headed by Dr. Richard Grazi in Brooklyn. But in Maimonides, the chaplain is Rabbi Abraham Avram Friedlander, a Hasidic fellow, very nice, very learned fellow. So he's written a number of books on halacha and the hospital and doctors. It's called Chastei Avram. So in one of his volumes, he has a section of letters and Shilas and Shuvas responses. So one of which he sent to Rav Shmuel HaLevi Vozner, one of the big poskim in Bnei Brak, regarding issues of fertility. So one of it has to do with the fact that oftentimes when in vitro fertilization protocols are followed, which we'll just step back for a moment just to review in vitro fertilization. Basically, the process of in vitro fertilization, which developed in England, 73 approximately, I don't remember right now offhand, but has been around now for many years and has generated literally a few million babies as a result of in vitro fertilization. So in vitro fertilization, when indicated for a particular couple, allows for an egg, an oocyte, a follicle. The follicle in the woman's ovaries, a woman is born with hundreds of thousands of follicles. Each follicle contains an egg, or an oocyte. It's actually very fascinating. Just the biology of it is very fascinating to contrast the reproductive system of a woman and the reproductive system of a man. It's very fascinating, if you think about it, just to step back for a moment, that when a female is an embryo, when a female is an embryo or fetus, mainly just a couple months old inside her mother's uterus, that fetus, which is not very large, that fetus is already developing eggs to allow for the next generation. She hasn't even been born yet. She hasn't even had a shalom bas yet. She hasn't been able to plan her bat mitzvah. She already, when she's about 3, 4, 5 months old in utero, is already producing very early, very immature, but already developing follicles, oocytes, eggs, to be able to give rise to the next generation that she hasn't even seen her generation. As opposed to males who really don't start the process of reproductive capacity until puberty. So as a woman is born with a few hundred thousand eggs, oocytes, actually, I'm mistaken. She's born with about 1 million to 2 million. By the time she reaches puberty, it's down to about 400,000. And part of that has to do with kind of a natural selection, namely that the contrasting again female and male reproductive systems, female reproductive systems focus on quality. Male reproductive system focuses on quantity. And female reproductive system focuses on having a healthy, high-level quality egg. Because every cycle, generally speaking, with exceptions, when a woman ovulates in mid-cycle, she releases one and only one, occasionally two, occasionally more than two, but generally speaking, on every cycle, she releases one mature egg. Of the hundreds of thousands that she has, only one. And that one is fertilized, but it can only be fertilized if the male has ejaculated literally millions and millions of sperm into the female reproductive tract, and a few hundred of them from the millions that are ejaculated reach the fallopian tube, and one of them will fertilize. So the contrast there. So if in vitro fertilization basically fundamentally uses a principle where the way it's practiced today is that a woman's ovaries are stimulated to produce maximum number of mature eggs, as opposed to the natural cycle, which produces one mature egg, one mature oocyte per cycle. The stimulation that's usually part of the protocol of IVF stimulates the woman's ovaries to produce several, anywhere from 1 to 16, 20 or so, 25 even, depending on the age of the woman and the health of her ovaries, but stimulates, and then these are aspirated, these are withdrawn, and then the husband produces a sperm sample, and the sperm sample is processed in laboratory, and then the two are basically mixed together in a petri dish with appropriate nourishment environment, and fertilization can occur. There are other procedures that can be used to assist that process of fertilization, but that's basically what happens. So if one of those eggs is fertilized by one of those sperm, then it creates an embryo, or technically speaking a pre-embryo, but we'll call it an embryo. Embryo basically is the period of from the time of conception through the first 2 months of pregnancy, and then from 3 months through 9 months is the fetus. So the embryo that's created in vitro is allowed to develop. It begins as one single cell, and then it starts to divide. And there are different protocols, whether it wait 3 days, whether 5 days of growth in the laboratory, in the proper medium, in the proper environment and temperature, whether 3 days or 5 days. But then the embryo, now being of multiple cell structure, many cells, anywhere from, say, 8 cells to more than that, is now transferred back into the woman's uterus and hopefully implants, and then gives rise to a healthy pregnancy and the birth of a fetus.
Did you put all the eggs in addition early
morning? It's a good question whether they have separate petri dishes for each one. They generally put, I think, one follicle in each petri dish and then have several, sperm in there. And then they'll see whether or not they take, and then each one can become an embryo. I think they put them in separate petri dishes. These are like not necessarily large petri, these are like small petri dishes, I believe, where they put them in. And they have the embryo and then put in sperm to mix and then hopefully fertilize. I don't think they mix several in one. I think in just one. Right, so you can't. So the eggs don't have. It's hard to freeze eggs, although there is a product program now of being able to freeze eggs, but it's more recent. It's not. It is easy to freeze eggs in a way that they will remain healthy and be able to be viably fertilized in the future. So generally, the protocol is to fertilize all the embryos, fertilize all the eggs. Some of them will successfully fertilize, some of them will not. And then their protocol is to take, depending on the circumstance, the age of the woman, protocols of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine in terms of the number of embryos that would be transferred back, anywhere from 1 to 3, depending on the age. If you look at the website of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, they have protocols as to how many embryos should maximally be transferred into a woman during a particular cycle, because needless to say that if you transfer, let's say, 5 back, then the potential of all 5 implanting and having a high gestational pregnancy of multiple pregnancy, which creates complications both for the fetuses and for the woman. So to avoid that, there are protocols, 1, 2, 3, depending. So the rest, so that was Rabbi Friedlander's Shiloh. His Shiloh was, the rest of them can be frozen. You can freeze freeze embryos. That's a very well-developed process of freezing embryos. It's not necessarily as good as fresh embryos. There's literature on that. But nonetheless, that is a successful protocol to freeze embryos. So they freeze the embryos. And there's a certain amount of time that they freeze them, and then after that, you have to pay for additional freezing time. You have to give a close cold cash. That's Detroit humor. That's okay. Not Midwestern humor, just Detroit humor. So Rav Friedlander asked Rav Ozhner, well, there's a problem with freezing embryos. Why? Because what happens if the couple divorces or if the husband dies? And then she wants to use the frozen embryo either when she remarries or when she's single, whatever the case may be, and it could create problems. What problem would it create? So he specifically addresses the issue of havchana. There is a halacha that if a woman gets divorced, or if a woman is widowed, then before she remarries, she has to wait 3 months, actually 92 days from the time, let's say, of the get or of the death of her husband, has to wait a period of 3 months, basically. Shlosha chodshei havchana. Havchana means to discern, to discriminate. Why? Because the possibility is that if she becomes pregnant, we won't know whether the pregnancy is from the previous husband or from the next husband. So if you wait a period of time after which, if she is pregnant from the previous husband, it will be apparent. The Gemara has a concept of hukaru bara, that a woman is readily, apparently pregnant after 3 months. So therefore, if you wait that period of time. So he says, but there's no way to monitor this. Because a woman, let's say, is divorced. She has these embryos, and she meets somebody, and she wants to get married, and they set a date for 2 months from now. And before she gets married, she wants to have the embryo. She doesn't want to do it when she's a married woman, which is a different issue, which I'm not getting into. And she wants to have it now. But you should have to wait 3 months, because what if she becomes pregnant, but you won't know if it's from the first husband's sperm that fertilized her egg and created the embryo, or is from her second marriage? So that was his concern. So Rav Ozhner responded to that by saying that not that that isn't a potential issue, but to say that one shouldn't freeze the embryos because of that possibility, which is not a high possibility. Yes, it does happen, and if it happens, it's an issue that needs to be addressed. We'll come back to it in by Rav Auerbach in just a moment. But to say that in a situation where it isn't already that case, where you have a divorced woman or a situation like that, where you have a couple and they want to freeze the embryos, to be concerned to forbid the freezing of the embryos because of that possibility is not concerned. Plus, he points out that in general, you have to have the consent of both to be able to use those frozen embryos once again. So if they got divorced, you'll need both. So like in this case that we just described in Chicago. So he wasn't so concerned about that. Dr. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, as quoted in Shulchan Shlomo, has the following discussion. First of all, he says that in terms of basically defining a certain degree of relationship between, he's specifically talking about the zera. In his context, he's talking about the zera, namely that the husband donated sperm and the sperm has not been used. He's talking about specifically a different procedure. He's talking about what used to be referred to as artificial insemination, now more commonly known as in utero insemination, IUI, and in utero insemination, where intrauterine insemination, where the sperm of, let's say, the husband is basically deposited directly into the uterus. Normally, when a man deposits through normal ejaculation sperm, it goes into the woman's earlier part of the reproductive tract through the vagina, which then has to go through the cervical canal, then into the uterus, then up to the fallopian tube. So that's quite a journey. And it's a journey that, of the millions of sperm, only a couple hundred actually make it to the fallopian tube, and that's good. So to maximize the potential for pregnancy, intrauterine insemination was developed, where they take the sperm, first of all they concentrate it, and they basically insert it high up in the uterus, much closer to the fallopian tube. You kind of circumvent a lot of the journey, a lot of the pathway, as well as some of the hazards along the pathway. The female reproductive tract is not always so hospitable to sperm cells in terms of its pH, in terms of its acidity, in terms of other things. So therefore, that's what he's talking about. So he's talking about the zera of a man. So he talks about a very interesting case. He says, what if you have a man who produced a sperm sample for purposes of inseminating his wife, and then he died. And they don't have children. So the question is, yibum. Question is Yibum. See, he has a brother. So do you have to do Yibum or Chalitza? Chalitza. You have to do Yibum or Chalitza. Namely, do you have, basically there's already a connection called a Zika, a connection between the woman and her brother-in-law, because she lost her husband without children. So his brother has the mitzvah of Yibum, just related to Megillas Rus, we just read on Shavuos, of Yibum or Chalitza, removing the shoe protocol. So he wants to know. So he says that because at the time of death, the sperm had not yet been inseminated, even if it does end up inseminating her and creating a pregnancy, there's still a din of Yibum and Chalitza, because at the time that he died, it had not yet been inseminated. And at that time, there is an obligation. But he points out that the fact that he died does not sever the man's connection to the sperm. It's still his sperm. It's his sperm monetarily. How do I know? Shlomo Zalman says, because there's a din Yerusha. Namely, the child that could potentially be born from this can be Yoresh, the father who died. The child's not even literally conceived yet. The father died, yet the father's assets can be bequeathed to this, eventually, if he or she becomes an actual embryo, fetus, and child, can have a Yerusha. So there's a legal, monetary connection between the person who donates the sperm and the eventual child. So there's clearly that kind of relationship. So he says that in terms of that, he actually creates the possibility, though I don't think he accepts it, that you could argue that in a situation, usually when we determine certain parts of yichus, of Jewish status, it's based on the mother, and sometimes based on the father. Whether a person is Jewish or not, we follow based on the machlokus and the gemara, but we paskin matrilineal descent by the mother. But in terms of, let's say, whether a person's a kohen or a levi, when people when used to ask me whether I'm a Kohen or a Levi, I said, no, I'm Hungarian. So then I have from both my parents. So the Kohen, you see, he says, Rav Shlomo Zalman suggests, more academically, suggests, well, if a man is a Kohen and his wife and his wife is a Bas Yisrael, she's a non-Kohen, let's say. So the child normally would be a Kohen, right? He says, but maybe if you use intrauterine insemination, where the husband did not inject his sperm immediately, as is the norm in terms of a normal process of pregnancy, and it was something that he generated independently, and now it's going to be introduced into his wife, maybe in that case they are both equals, and the child would be half Kohen, half Yisrael. That's what he says, that he'd have basically two parents who are like equal status. He does in terms of a more of an academic pilpul that he discusses, but the notion is just an interesting one. So he says, though, that connection is very important. So he says, then, regarding this issue that Rabbi Friedlander raised, that if you're going to allow freezing of embryos, or leave it out, you have a woman, husband divorces her, and she wants to use the embryos. So leaving out his consent or opposition, which we'll come to in a moment as the major focus, but just the issue of hafchana. Does you have to worry about the fact that if she's going to be allowed to use the embryos, it could potentially occur that she'll remarry before the 3 months and you won't know who the father is. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach talks about that, and he discusses whether or not that kind of situation, that unique situation, that kind of situation, for whatever reasons, is really under the governance of that halacha. Maybe the halacha doesn't even apply in that case. But he says, for sure, if you have a situation where the woman already remarried and now you're going to inseminate, whether leaving out other halachic issues with inseminating a married woman with a donor sperm, that's a separate discussion, which I'm not getting into now. But leaving that out, says once she already is remarried, then you don't have to worry about hafchana. Hafchana means that before a woman gets remarries, you have to determine, is the potential pregnancy, is she pregnant from the first husband or not? If she's already remarried, then the halach is no longer applicable. Namely, you don't have to break up the marriage. You don't have to tell them they have to abstain. It's a halacha in advance of a marriage. So if she's divorced, then she might have to wait. That's what he discusses, but maybe in this case not. But that's just in terms of one issue. The main issue, though, that I want to discuss is basically addressed by a wonderful series of articles, but one in particular by a journal called Techumen. It's more like a book, but Techumen is a very scholarly halachic work, comes out pretty much annually from Tzomet in Israel on all kinds of topics of military, economics, modern technology, and refuah, and halachic medical issues. So they have, in one of the volumes of a few years ago, they have this issue regarding the following: Hapiryach chutz gufit eitzel zug parud, that in vitro fertilization, that's hapiryach chutz gufit, in vitro, outside of the body, with respect to a couple who are separated. The specific case that was brought to a Beis Din, and one of the members of Beis Din in Yerushalayim wrote this article, Rav Avram Sherman. So it was brought to a Beis Din, I guess in Yerushalayim, but I'm not sure if it was in Yerushalayim specifically, or he's just writing it, one of the members of the Beis Din Yerushalayim. But the question was the following. There was a couple that got married, but they haven't had the blessing of children. And over time, they basically decided to engage in vitro fertilization, create embryos. And she had a few cycles and were not successful. But now she wants a third cycle of transferring embryos. And at this point already, apparently there had been strain in the relationship from the beginning, for whatever reasons, and the husband basically really is interested in divorcing. She is, she isn't, whatever the case may be. And so she wants, regardless of whatever happens to their marriage, she wants to be able to use those embryos. And he opposes it. He opposes it. He doesn't want to be kind of forced into becoming a parent. He doesn't want to allow it. He's basically opposed and feels that he doesn't have an obligation. She even agreed, in this case it is, that she even agreed to support the child, that he would have no support responsibilities until the age, and he, she would support the child and through the age of 18 or so, but he was opposed to it. So there was a whole discussion about whether or not he has the right to oppose or not. So that's a case where the couple is still married halachically, technically, legally, but they are separated. That's one case. There's another case that they refer to of a case in which the couple was already divorced, and a similar question came up, divorced. So he discusses the similarities and differences. So one of the issues that is discussed here is the issue of shutfus. That do we view this embryo as belonging to a partnership, like a corporation? Corporation in this case is a small corporation, a partnership corporation. The partner is the woman and the man who are now, let's say, separated. So are they the partners? So her lawyer's claim was that if it's a partnership, and they engaged and entered into this partnership to create a pregnancy, to create a family, then neither partner has the right to kind of rescind. They committed to a partnership. And a shutfus, a partnership, requires, based on sources that they quote, to kind of see the partnership through. So that assumes that there is a partnership and that there is something of a kind of entity that is owned or there are rights about or to. That's what one of the Danoim discusses. Can you say that someone owns an embryo? You can say that I own a body part. Retrusky was talking about organ donation before, so he was talking about, you know, in regards to that. One can say that a person owns perhaps one's organs, but can one say that one owns another life? So an embryo is a potential life. Can you say that they're really owners? Maybe we have responsibilities vis-a-vis those embryos, but can we say that this woman is a part owner and this man is a part owner and therefore they are in a legal partnership and whatever the ramifications of that partnership may be? Or can you say not that something that's an embryo already is an embryo? It's a living entity on some level, on a biologic level, on a potential level, and it's not something that's open to proprietary rights and therefore maybe there isn't that kind of partnership. One can certainly be an owner over one's egg, an owner over one's sperm, because those independently are not living beings. Those are parts of one's body. But once they are mixed together in vitro fertilization and there's fertilization that occurs, then the embryo is a living entity, a living organism, potentially, that maybe one can't say there's a partnership, which means that if there's no partnership, she can't hold him obligated to live up to his side of the partnership if there is no partnership to begin with. That's part of the discussion. Right, that's true. The Gemara in Kedushin, you're absolutely right. The Gemara in Kedushin talks about that there are shlosha shutfin ba'adam, three partners. There's a father, mother, and God. That's what we talked about in terms of kibud avim, equating the obligation of honoring God and honoring parents. The Gemara actually delineates what components come from the mother, what components come from the father, and from God. So the Gemara refers to it as a shutfis. So the question is, do you take that Gemara literally, that it's a legal partnership? The Gemara means that gimel shutfin, there are three people who partner in the creation of. Not in a legal sense, but in a kind of metaphysical, religious, and biologic sense, they partner in the process, not that they are necessarily halakhic shutfin. But you're right, that term does appear there, and whether or not that sheds light on this, that's a good question. Whether you interpret it as literally that the Gemara uses that term shutfin to connote a certain ownership, or whether it's a partnership in a process rather than a partnership in a kind of ownership. That's a good point. Thank you. Rav Sherman points out that the partnership, if you assume it was a partnership, and that was the woman's claim, that it's a partnership and you have to live up to your partnership parts of it. So one of the claims that the partnership was not what she's asking for. Now, the partnership, when they were more, I guess, harmoniously married, was to create a family, to build a family. That no longer is apparently potentially possible, because they're going to go through apparently separation and divorce. What she's asking for now is to have the potential of having a child on her own. That's not what the partnership was about. The partnership was about having a family together, not about having her have the ability to have a child. That's one of the arguments on his behalf. In the discussion, they also discussed the fact that you can say it's a partnership, but this partnership went through a major change that totally surrenders the partnership no longer viable. Namely, in the case where they quote from Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who discussed another situation where there was actual divorce. So the partnership was set up in a situation where they were married. If there's divorce, then that automatically cancels the original partnership. The partnership didn't stipulate that we, this couple, whether we're married or divorced. It was a married couple. If they get divorced, then the whole corporation is no longer in existence as it was originally formulated, so you can't say there's a partnership. So they want to claim on his behalf that the fact that this kind of the stress in the relationship result in separation now kind of reformulates the corporation, the partnership, in a way that was not the original consent, and therefore that's what the general psak of the Beis Din was, that you can't impose upon him to implant the embryo. However, they say the following. They say, while we can't, as a Beis Din, compel the husband, who's separated and leading towards divorce, to agree to allow the embryos to be implanted in his present legal wife. However, there is a kind of moral obligation that he has based on chesed, also related to Megillas Rus. Chesed, just like Megillas Rus, reflects chesed and chasadim that were not required, that were not mandatory. That's what chesed ultimately is. So chovas habal ligmol chesed. He has a mitzvah, a moral mitzvah of doing chesed. This woman wants to have a child. And this was, I think, also a case of a woman who was sick and had chemotherapy. I think it was also that kind of situation. Therefore, as a result, she was unable to develop her own subsequently. I think that's why they froze them. So she's not going to be able to have on her own. So she wants to be able to have a child. So the proper thing for the husband to do is leave out the legalities. You may be right that it's not a corporation, a partnership that you are obligated to kind of oblige by at this point in time, but do a chesed for her. So while you can't obligate him in Beis Din to compel him to do a chesed, in a sense that defies the whole purpose of a chesed, but they can't even kofin, so they can't even compel him, they can't force him, there's a notion of performing that chesed, that he should at least perform the chesed for her and allow her to be an acquiesce, to allow her to be able to have that opportunity. That's some of the discussions associated with it. If you think about Gemaras have principles that sometimes when you have a partnership, there is a certain ability to kind of compel one partner to either buy out the other or sell in a situation where you can't really divide the entity. So in this case, you have an embryo. You can't divide an embryo. They can't each take half the embryo. That's not possible. Potentially, it is possible, depending on what stage of development, you can perhaps separate out, but that's not in a normal protocol. One wouldn't do so. So you can't really split the embryo. So you could argue that you tell the husband, look, if you either buy her share out or sell your share out. But to keep it in this way where they can't actually split it, because what's going to happen to it? If it is a shutfis, if it is a partnership, so they're never going to be able to divide it. So it's just going to kind of lay in state. And it's going to just lay there, or they'll just discard it, throw it out, let it thaw out, depending whether you follow the Jewish or the Catholic approach to get to discarding embryos that are not going to be used anymore. So that's not a way to resolve a shutfis. Fine, you want to say that shutfis is not an absolute shutfis anymore, but what are you going to do with the embryo? So it seems that it's not unreasonable to suggest that the husband should either be compelled to buy out his share, which he's not interested in, or sell. So let her buy your half, however how much you want to sell it for, let her buy it out. The only difference is that it's not exactly like that, because even if he sells his share out, he'll always have a share, because it will be his son. It will be his son or daughter, whatever the case may be. So that's something that, you know, and then of course you can't, you know, can't split. So that's a little bit of weakness in that suggestion that I'm raising. So those are some of the issues regarding proprietary ownership rights, regarding embryos and the like, and how it manifests in terms of situations where a couple gets divorced or one dies and using. There are situations in which it comes up, unfortunately, if the husband, there are cases like that where a husband is sick and is undergoing chemotherapy, and before so kind of provides sperm to fertilize his wife's oocytes or eggs and freezes them as embryos and then to be used subsequently, and what the status of those embryos are after he dies, or what if you have an engaged couple and the husband's been diagnosed with a cancer and produces in advance before they're married, what the halakhic issues regarding that is. That's also discussed in the postgum. So just wanted to touch upon some of that and perhaps take some questions or comments. Yes. We were chavrusas in YU many years ago, and I had the privilege of having one of Dr. Wisniewski's daughters as students during college. Oh, I had both. Did I have both? Okay. That's what Shlomo Zalman quotes from other posthum, not specifically from Revision, but he quotes that the concept of Havchana is before a woman gets married, you have to make sure that her next marriage is crisply demarcated from the previous one in terms of any potential pregnancy, so you know that if there's pregnancy, you either know it's from the first or the second. Once a woman has been remarried, any issue of Havchana, it's a lechachila to do. Once a woman is already remarried, the Havdin Havchana is not relevant. Yes. What does he say? Why does he argue? Let me just see his exact wording. He says that if at the time they got married, it was permissible for them to get married. Namely, the husband died, or the husband and she were divorced. She remarries. She hasn't done any procedure yet. So she's permitted to get married to this other person. Now she wants to consider using the embryo from before and implanting it into her uterus. So that's a case where this couple already permissibly got married. So in that case, leslamo kivin de beheter nasav lo bayi hafrasha, doesn't require separation of the two of them to determine. Presumably in that case, How will you know whether she gets pregnant naturally or so there may be ways to monitor that. Whether you're obligated to do that, that's a good question. It probably makes sense to do so. But in terms of the din of Havchana, which requires a separation period before marriage, or the question about separating while they're married, so separating while they're married would not be. So that becomes a separate issue about inseminating a married woman with whose sperm? So that's a major issue. Can you use donor sperm? And if you can, whose? Jewish or not Jewish? And that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a novel opinion which he develops in a very lengthy article published many years ago in Noam, where he develops a notion, a very, very forceful argument, that if you have a Jewish man donate sperm to a married Jewish woman, married to someone else, then even if the sperm is inseminated, it's not as if they have any intimacy together. He's a Jewish man. He donates his sperm. It's inseminated into her because, let's say, the husband doesn't produce sperm, whatever the case may be. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach argues that very, very likely that child would be a mamzer. So that's why using a non-Jewish sperm donor would potentially be an option. Using a Jewish one would not. What? Right, so that's a good question, whether or not you would apply the potential of mamzer once the embryo is already created. When it's transferred into a married woman, that's a good question. I don't know. That's a good question, because there you already have the embryo. It's not as if you're inseminating. So already you have the embryo. So I'm just thinking out loud, if you already have the embryo, so you can't create mamzer anymore. Mamzer is when you create a pregnancy through another man's sperm. Here the sperm is gone. The sperm is literally gone. The only thing that's left is the genetics of it that is now kind of promulgated within the embryo. So you could argue in that case the embryo is related to the other man, but it's not creating mamzer. That's I'm just thinking out loud. It's a good question. I'm just thinking out loud. I don't know the answer for sure. Yes? Yes, so if there are, it's not uncommon that in assisted reproductive technology clinics, there are extra embryos that are unneeded, unwanted, either because couples have already successfully had pregnancies and they're not looking to have more, or whatever the case may be, so discard. So one possibility, there are different possibilities. One possibility is to use them for research. That's one possibility, which will require their destruction in the process of using them for research. Another is to simply dispose of them, just throw them out, discard them. So the Catholic Church is of the opinion that you can't do that, generally speaking, because they believe that once you create an embryo, even if it's not done inside the woman's reproductive tract, it already has gained the process of ensoulment. It's already been endowed with a soul, and therefore you can't discard it. So what their general recommendation, I think, of the Catholic Church is, if you aren't going to use it anymore and you don't want to keep it frozen, then you basically take it out of the liquid nitrogen, which keeps it frozen at very low temperatures, and you let it kind of thaw out and let it kind of disintegrate on its own. It's a principle of Shevi Al Tasa, doing it passively rather than actively. The general consensus in the post-skim, the general consensus, is that that's not necessary, that you can actively discard it, that unless an embryo has been transferred back, which dovetails on your question about the mamzer, until it's been transferred into a woman's uterus, it doesn't have a status of being a nefesh, a live entity of any kind, and therefore it doesn't have a halachic status, it can be discarded. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, I think, is of the opinion that if you've designated them to be used for transfer and then end up not, once they've been designated, you can't discard them. If they've never been designated for transfer, then you can. I'm not sure exactly what the difference is, 100%, but there are different opinions there. But the general consensus, the RCA's opinion is, Best in of America, of rabbinical councils, that they can be discarded, or they can be donated to research. Donated to someone else, you can't. So you can't really donate them to another couple, because then you get into all kinds of issues of identity. Because this embryo has this mother, this father, and now it's going to be donated to another couple who will, let's say, then be the surrogate carrier, and that creates a triad that the postcum are very much opposed to. Like, basically, surrogacy and surrogate motherhood, in general, it's not something that would be public. There already you create more of an issue, which, in a sense, is maybe similar to that embryo issue, even if it may not be mamzer, but it creates other potential issues. But those are good questions. Yes?
Can you needs for husband and wife to get married. What do you think about the child?
In which case again? I'm sorry. If
where they're married, and mm-hmm. they're going to implant the previous embryo.
Right.
What do you do about the ichus of the child?
Well, the ichus of
the child. Husband,
right.
Is he going to the current husband?
No, there you. There. No, you'd say that this child is not related to the new husband. The child is related to the woman.
You don't know.
Oh, in case, so that comes back to the child. I would assume, although he doesn't address it explicitly, I would assume in that case that the recommendation would be, even if it's not a halachic recommendation, the halachic requirement is not that they have to separate to ensure that. They can continue living as husband and wife. But I would think that the halachic recommendation is that there should be some monitoring to ensure in some way that the pregnancy of the potential pregnancy of the embryo is allowed to develop or not develop. One way to do that is to perhaps use birth control for a period of time for the new couple to assure that. I don't know that you can halachically mandate that, but that would certainly be a halachic recommendation to ensure that that is determined. It's just that the requirement of Afkana requires a separation or an inability of having a relationship. In this case, we can't prohibit that because they're already married and they got married permissibly, says Rosh HaMazon based on Achronim. But you can still require or certainly recommend, I don't know if you can absolutely require, but you can recommend that they ensure in some way that until this embryo has either implanted and successfully created a pregnancy or not, that there be monitoring or there be some form of intervention that would prevent the possibility of confusion. That's a good point that you make.
All right. We want to thank very much Rabbi Dr. Weiss. We want to thank everybody for